You are listening to Right Back At Ya, the 2000s pop music podcast where we have fun taking pop music seriously. Hosted by, he's had many a bad haircut, but even more fabulous ones, David Lim. And me, the number one nothing good about this goodbye, Stan. You might even say I'm addicted to it, Joel Babington. Hello, David. Now, we have a very special guest on the podcast today, don't we?
You know, us here on a podcast, we love a good bit of pop justice, don't we, JB?
Absolutely.
She has been called one of Britain's best-kept pop secrets. Miss Alexis Strum is a singer-songwriter who a lot of you eternally online pop fans would recognise as the writer behind the gorgeous fan-favourite Rachel Stevens album track, Nothing Good About This Goodbye, which the JB just referenced just then. But also Kylie's very cute Body Language album track, Still Standing. You know, Alexis worked with so many of our faves, JB. Brian Higgins of Xenomania, Richard X, Billy Steinberg, the legend, two major label albums that never saw the light of day. Absolute travesty.
Criminal.
Until last year, she got it released. She did her thing. And now she's here with us to chat about how she did it. Please welcome to Right Back At Ya, Alexis Strum.
Hello, Alexis. How are you doing?
Hi. Well, I love the intro. I mean, if I ever die, which is unlikely, you can do my obituary.
Well, it's a running gag on the podcast, but we are available.
Love it. No, it's great. I'm very well, thank you. I've just been playing dolls with my daughter. And we did, It was great. We did, we're doing a talent show with all of the LOL dolls. And One of them did a one-woman show. It was woeful. Another one did some catwalk. I mean, this is the way to hang on a Thursday. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, instantly from that, I'm getting that your daughter, who from social media, I think is a bit of an icon in her own right. She's hilarious.
I'll tell her that.
I feel like she's getting all fleshes of Alexis Strum's career there. With the dolls, we're getting some comedy, we're getting some acting. I bet some music gets involved in there sometimes. She's just got one woman Alexis Strum experience going on.
Which is probably entertaining for the most part, probably annoying and embarrassing as she gets older. But it's great. I have to say, having a daughter just makes everything so much more fun. And especially going back into music again and just like experiencing what I'm experiencing now and remembering everything that I do. I remember where I was last time around, and I was 20 something and single and didn't have a daughter. So it's really funny because I keep getting thrown back into that body and that mindset. But I'm someone who's way more experienced now.
I mean, we're going to get right back to the beginning and we're going to talk through everything. But while we're on that, how has this been for your daughter, this huge Alexis Strum resurgence? Did she already know Mummy was a pop star, or is this brand new information to her?
This was brand new information.
Wow, exciting for her.
Yeah, super exciting. When I started doing little TikToks when, you know, things were starting to kick off last year, she was getting to know my songs. And then over the last couple of months, when we've been traveling in the car together, I did a gig up in Scotland, for example. I've been playing the album, Cocoon, and she's sings. Sometimes she'll be singing around the house and she sings bits of The Long Way Home. Aww. And I'm like, oh my God. It's like, I've literally got the biggest ego
boost.
Thank you. In human form. That's all I created her for, obviously.
Well, she must have heard you singing, right? Presumably as she was growing up. Or did you not sing really around the house?
Oh, that's a good question. I used to sing to her every night to send her to sleep. And that's the only singing I did for years and years and years. So I didn't sing in the car. I didn't sing in the shower. I turned everything off in my whole being. You know, I just didn't want to sing anymore because it was just made me feel sad. But then, you know, kind of the last few years, I'd say, you know, maybe the last 3 or 4 years, I've really gotten into listening to music again. Funnily enough, kind of stuck in the 2000s in my musical taste, but I've allowed.
We can't relate.
Yeah, I know. I thought you might.
I mean, look, we've quickly touched on where we're at now, but let's go all the way back to the beginning. How did the road to Alexis Strum pop star start?
So I was always really certain that I was going to become a pop star. That was never really any question over that. So when I was about 14, I think it was, I decided I had to learn an instrument so I could start writing songs. And I bought a guitar from Loot, which was the newspaper back then before the internet where you buy stuff like that. And I bought a secondhand guitar and taught myself to play. And then I started getting guitar lessons at school and joining school bands. I was always like very much on the alternative side of music, and the bands that I formed at school were very alternative. And then I sort of experimented with four-track recording. I got my first four-track recording device. I guess it was like a tape player sort of thing. And would make my own versions of Nirvana songs and Hole songs. When I left school, I went to university. I went to King's in London, and just continued that on along that path, you know, buying, I was chatting to Hannah Robinson this week, fantastic songwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause we live,
we love her.
She's amazing. And we live near each other. I hope she won't mind me mentioning, but, we were saying how we used to reply to every single ad at the back of Melody Maker and the NME. So anyone who was like songwriter looking for, singer, band looking for, vocalist, da da da, whatever it was. I mean, I went to every single audition I could, but that was what I did. So every week I'd just be meeting new people, and eventually I met some guys who were published by Warner Chappell, and because they were published, when I wrote a song with them, their publisher heard it and said, "Oh, who's this girl?" And that, you know, that was kind of the start of getting into the actual music business rather than being on the periphery. And then once you're in, you know, if you are fortunate enough to get a publishing deal or a recording deal, you know the landscape. And it's just about staying in there, staying in as long as you can.
So there's that publishing deal with Warner first, and then there was the record deal that came after, I guess. So
yeah.
Was there like that kind of fork road where you thought, okay, I could carry on being a songwriter, or no, this is my moment. I'm going to go for it, and I'm going to see if I can get a deal to do my own thing as an artist.
I kind of fell into songwriting. I didn't really know what it was. I just, through singing and wanting to be heard, then it was like, well, you've got to have material. And I sort of fell into it, and I was just very fortunate in that respect. But I never wanted to just be a songwriter. I was always writing songs for me to sing, which I found hard. And it's taken me probably, you know, best part of 20 years to come to peace with that, because I haven't got a very big ego, surprisingly, for someone who tries to be a pop star. I really don't. And I found that hard to kind of be like, well, no, I don't want to just be a songwriter. I want to sing my own stuff. Mm. And actually, if I'd realized that I just had to have a little bit more gumption about it, I probably wouldn't have made some of the decisions I did. But I've never turned down a cut. No one's ever said, oh, you know what, I really want this particular song. And then I've gone, oh, no, I couldn't possibly because I'm an artist. I'm always very happy to give a song away because I think you can always write more.
Mm. Well, that's a very songwriterly instinct as well, because you kind of know that, oh, I'm the source and I can do it. So, but I love that assurance there. So you've got this deal with Warner for yourself, for your artist project. And along came, I guess, these sessions that built to Addicted, right? The album.
Yeah.
Which was originally set for release in 2002. Can you tell me what the process was like when you were making that album?
Yeah. I mean, it was a wonderful time. It was so much fun because I was primarily writing with these two guys that lived in Bromley who were just like really randos that happened to be signed as songwriters. I don't know. We were sort of young and it was just fun and there wasn't any seriousness to it or pressure. And we just happened to write a whole bunch of songs that I cherry picked the ones I thought would be right for me that really did suit where I wanted to go. Like it wasn't like, oh, I've kind of crowbar this in. I loved those songs at the time because it was very much how I was, this young, vibrant girl going out meeting guys and getting up to whatever. And that's what the songs were all about. You know, it was a very, very sexually fun time. And it's reflected in those songs. So I had a great time. And towards the end of that writing period, that was when I had a session with Brian Higgins and Xenomania, etc. That's when I started writing with people like Magnus Fiennes, who I've gone on to write with again. And I was sort of finding my people. I was talking to a publisher the other day, actually, because I'm back songwriting again. And he said, you know, it's It's like dating, and it is, because you get put with these different rando people and you might not click at all. They could be an excellent songwriter and you might be, but nothing great comes out of that session. But it was, yeah, it was a wonderful time. It was a wonderful time in music, early 2000s.
2002 was such a great time for pop. Like, when we think about the music that we cover on here, like Sugar Babes are doing Freak Like Me with Richard X, we've got Liberty X, we've got S Club Juniors, they're all out there doing their thing. We love it, and we love it unashamedly, but it was always that thing of like, is it cool, quote unquote?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
How did you feel about that at the time? And then also, who were the pop acts at the time that you admired, or was there anyone you wanted to be collaborating with at that time?
Good question. So I think around that time, I felt very much like they were my peers, even though I hadn't had an album out, because I was working with the same songwriters,
absolutely,
the same stylists, hairdressers, whatever. And we were making videos, and I was doing all the same promotional tours, because in those days you had to do all the ILR, independent local radio tours, going around the country. So I'd see them all and we'd be like, oh, there's Busted. Oh, there's Darius. Rest in peace. Mm. And all these wonderful people that I just felt very much a part of it, even though obviously now I look back and I never actually made it at the time, but I was very much geared to be a success, you know? So I felt very much like they were my peers. I remember being up for doing the Justin Timberlake tour. I was like shortlisted to do that. And
Wow.
Yeah. And then we did, so we were trying to sort of convince them. We did a remix of, or a mashup of Addicted with Like I Love You, I think it was, or one of Justin's tracks.
I can hear it.
Yeah.
I can definitely hear it.
And then sent that to his team. And we, you know, I was like, I was always being considered for stuff. I was in that mold. So someone like Justin Timberlake, I would have, you know, killed to collaborate with. I was very conscious I was getting compared to like the Holly Valances and Danny Minogues, who were also around at the time. And I think in those days, it was difficult to position a female pop star, particularly someone who wrote their own stuff. Because that was like, I was sort of like coming at it, trying to fit in and be like sexy, sort of this electro pop sexy bitch. But can I say bitch?
Okay. Yes.
Sexy badge.
That's how we live our lives. We wake up every morning. We come on, you electro sexy bitch.
Exactly. So I was trying to be that, but it didn't quite fit that I was a little bit worthy, you know, and I wrote my stuff and I produced and stuff. And I, you know, so I didn't quite fit in. And I kind of look back now and go, okay, well, if I'd have come out now, it would be a very different story. The fact that I make my own music, and you mentioned you'd seen my studio set up, whatever. And, you know, that's now a point of interest rather than a point of weirdness.
Yeah. Because especially like the Addicted music video and the, correct me if it felt like it was different from your end, but it felt like it was going for that a bit edgier singer-songwriter-y vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't getting Danny Minogue or Holly. I was thinking like maybe Appleton's-esque.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm listening to the album, I was hearing that, okay, maybe like, when did Goldfrapp come out? Like, was this Goldfrapp-esque as well, you know?
I think it maybe it was just before, I feel like it was just before Black Cherry, but I'm not very good with the date.
Strict Machine-ish time.
Could have been,
possibly.
Yeah. I certainly was a fan of Moloko and Roisin, and I was just sort of, I guess that's where I in my head was going. But whereas perhaps the label weren't so sure. And I think that's why I think it's kind of a fault on both of our parts, because I wasn't clear enough about what I wanted to be and they weren't clear enough about what they would allow me to be.
Yeah.
So there was that disconnect. It wasn't a huge shock then when they were like, we don't know what to do next with you. So I don't know if it was that they let me go or we had a discussion and it was like, this is just not really working.
Now, before we even go there, I mean, you know, Addicted was earmarked to be your debut single. I mean, how do you look back on that song? Because I love that riff. Like, it is so sexy. Did that feel like the right song to launch with?
I don't even remember. I don't remember being part of those conversations, having those conversations.
Really?
I don't know. It just kind of like, I had managers, I had people around me, and I didn't have the same personality that I think I've developed now, which has a hardness to it and, you know, a lot more experience. So I think I just would have gone along with anything. And if they said, oh, we think that's the right vibe, yeah, cool. I mean, looking back, my favourite track of the album was Coming On Strong. And that was,
ooh, yeah,
you know, I love that. I still, if I listen to that and it comes on, you know, on my phone or whatever, I'm like, yeah, that was really... That summed up that album for me and that music. So I'd like to have gone with that, but I don't
think... It was a sexy bitch song.
It was a sexy bitch really song, and I was in my sexy bitch power. I was having so much fun then, and now...
We're all a sexy bitch inside, you know?
still am, babes.
Like, I go to work every morning, and I've got this playlist called... it's called like Pump Up Bitch, Let's Do This. And it's listening, it's me, the same 10 songs, all from like 2001. Oh. And it just gives me that strut into work before all, you know, anxiety comes creeping in. You've got like, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah.
So I think we've all got that sexy bitch in there.
Please, can I be on that playlist?
Yeah,
I'm
adding it straight away.
Thank
absolutely.
Thank you.
The Addicted music video. Black and white, cool, edgy look. It's you performing with a band. You're being sultry with around a pool table.
Mm-hmm.
By about like 2003, 2004, that is kind of what everyone was doing, and it was really popular. Did it feel like to you it was a little bit different or a little bit ahead of its time?
Do you know what? It's funny because I was talking to someone about Cocoon the other day and he said, you do realise you're about 10, 15 years ahead of your time on that one. And it's a really hard pill to swallow because, yeah, I think it was. And I think I've never really been very good at sort of playing by the rules or fitting to a formula or doing the right thing or doing the expected thing. So I was just doing what I wanted to do and what I felt was right musically. And that makes things ahead of their time because I'm not sitting there going, oh, Tate McRae sounds like this, so I'm going to make it sound like that. You know, I've never been that kind of writer or artist. So, yeah, probably some things were ahead of their time. Some were just bad. I mean, there's a couple from that album that I can't listen to. But people love, so I'm not going to say which tracks they are, but...
Oh, okay. We were going to ask because...
There's one in particular I literally cannot listen to now. And the thing is, though, I won't say because I know as a punter, when my favourite artists say, and I hate that song, it makes you like, oh, no, that makes me feel like an idiot because I like it. So I'm not even going to say. It might even be like a B-side. Who knows?
Good for you, girl. I mean, I feel like we always get that. Like we had the 411 on here and it was just after they'd done their big Hoopla gig and they were like, yeah, there's this pop song on the album called Chance. We hated it. Obviously, the gays fucking loved it because it was this big pop banger. And then they've just completely re-embraced it because it was the joy that it brings that they see the joy that it brings people.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that's I've got to get to that point. I need to play Mighty Hoopla. I haven't been asked.
Yes.
This needs to happen. So
we're putting it out there.
Put it in the universe. Come on, Mighty Hoopla. Addicted was my first big budget video. And my memory of that, and I've written about it before, like talked about it, was that they got these models in to play my friends in the video. And they were just wafting around each other, all hanging out. It was so rude. And no one would talk to me. And I felt like, you know, like it was like being back at school and being bullied or something.
Aww.
It was horrible. Sodder. And I'm like trying to be gorgeous and sexy and cool and fabulous and draping over my pool table and throwing the balls in the sockets and just thinking, oh, well, they're having a great time. You know, they're having a wonderful time. And no one, they just didn't speak to me. I'd rather have my own friends in it, you know. I remember watching that back and also because it's black and white. And as you know, black and white is very flattering. I remember seeing a clip of it at the end of the day and going, my God, I'm attractive. Obviously, you see, you know, the lighting, the makeup, everything was
the
so
hair,
exceptional.
Like
the
you
hair,
up against the wall. I was like, okay, we're giving sultriness. We're giving moves here.
That was the best looking day of my life. I've never since looked anything like that. And it does amuse me. I mean, Yeah, the prospect of being a pop star now and having to make a video and look decent in it, my God, that terrifies me.
As you said, you did all the kind of radio tours and the promos with all your fellow pop stars. I mean, were you able to gig a little bit outside of these promo appearances just to kind of find your audience and start, I mean, maybe trying out new material?
Nobody did that. No one really did that. Not unless you were a band, I suppose. Like if you were Coldplay, then you would. But as a pop artist, it was very regimented and very prescribed. You know, I was already doing miming on TV performances or whatever. It was like that was what you did. I did get to sing around ILR, but I never really met my fan base. And I think that's what's been so great about everything that happened last year is actually seeing, meeting and being in dialogues with people that are into your music, because I had no idea. So I kind of wish I'd done that, but yeah, it just wasn't done in those days.
You know, it's so important in knowing your audience and setting up that rapport back then, isn't it? That face-to-face connection.
It is. I think another consideration for that, and also with Cocoon, was the cost of touring, which is enormous. Mm. And obviously the money you make can be really high. Labels would pay artists to do tour support, so you weren't making money from it. It was a marketing tool.
Yeah,
and
a buy-on.
Yeah, exactly, a buy-on. Thank you, a buy-on. That was the term. But yeah, so like we just didn't have the money. As much as I was a major label artist with a huge budget, I mean, I used to get breakdowns of everything that had been spent. They did spend the money. You know, everyone in my band was a session player, getting a session rate per day. Then there was an MD. So that would be very expensive to tour. And I didn't have a fan base because the model back then was not to grow a fan base, as we've just discussed. So it was kind of like a weird chicken and egg situation, I think.
Speaking of not being able to grow this fan base, can we touch on the infamous, as revealed by you on your Twitter, infamous cancelled Lorraine TV performance?
Yeah, okay.
What the hell happened there?
Speaking of performances, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So when I it's funny, isn't it? Because I've blacked it out again from my head. Because
Sorry.
When I said I couldn't remember why the deal, the deal ended because I was booked to go on the Lorraine show, and the lyric in Addicted was, it was a metaphor about being addicted. And it says, I'm a junkie for Chunky Monkey, which was my favourite flavour of ice cream. And someone within her team thought that it was a drug reference and it was about crack cocaine. And it's odd because I can't believe none of us flagged it, including me. You know, I thought I'd been really clever and funny. And if you looked at me in the video and you appreciate it was from Warner Records and stuff, you know it wasn't going to be a drug reference. But I guess in some ways, maybe the video might have been misleading with its black and white grungy thing. And maybe they thought, she's kind of that heroin chic. I don't know. But either way, there was a misunderstanding. And when that TV appearance was pulled, everything dropped like dominoes, everything fell like dominoes, because in those days you had all these things set up. So the TV performances would have got you the playlist at Radio 1 and Radio 2, which would have got you a high single position, which then would have been
able to... It's that much of a longer lead, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, these days pop stars start teasing the little clips on TikTok just to like try to make it go viral. And it's actually roughly the same time period as about 6 weeks, isn't it, before you drop the track. So you were doing that with TV. So I didn't realise actually you were that far off from release date. Like it actually would have been the first piece of the domino to...
That's right.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, without that, I mean, could they not book you in another show?
No, because...
There were so many shows back then.
What happened was, word gets out. So that one, I had loads lined up. So I had, that was the first one. Then I had like another, I can't remember what it was. It was another daytime. And these people...
They all heard about Chunky Monkey and
They
wouldn't touch
you
it.
See,
there was no Urban Dictionary back then. They couldn't look
exactly.
it up.
Exactly.
Where was the response? Let's get Alexis in a photo opportunity with Ben and Jerry's now, surrounded by Chunky Monkey with the headline, cancelled from Lorraine.
Yeah, but you're thinking like someone with skills. You know, these are people who follow a set route. They don't think outside the box necessarily. And I'm not saying... That's Warner Records. I'm saying there were lots of different people brought in, you know, and whatever.
Yeah.
I had a huge team. And they just didn't think that way. And I think the thing is, you have a sense of humour. And I think you know, that a lot of what was lacking was a sense of humor and just like kind of, oh, come on, guys, let's just try that. All right, let's, do you know what? Yeah. It's fine, let's just try that.
But you did end up getting a response from Al Lorraine on Twitter, didn't you?
I did. And then the thing is, I was trying to get on her show because I thought that would have been really nice, like a nice bit of closure. You know, you look back and it's such a small detail, really, in what was inevitably not going to work out for whatever reason. And this happens every single day. Artists get dropped or make mistakes, or you release something and you think it's going to be big and it isn't, or you release a song and it's got a word in it that week is in the news and has been cancelled. Do you know what I mean? Like you have no control, anything could happen. So I certainly don't feel bitter about it, but I had to do a lot of work to not feel bitter about it.
So all that, as you say, you know, the domino pieces were falling there, but it seems like album samplers were sent out.
Mm.
Addicted was on there. Coming On Strong, which you mentioned, Rock This Disco, mm-hmm. Still Standing, and Nothing Good About This Goodbye. And now, thankfully, we've got the full album. So as far as you can remember, were there other singles earmarked in discussion after Addicted?
No, we never got that far. Because as you say, there was like that long lead time. You had the TV. So the video was on the box and MTV the whole time. Like, it was right up in the charts there. So nothing was really discussed any further than that. But it's so weird because I actually can't remember. And I think I have blocked a lot of it out because it was really, I just remember being, my boyfriend at the time lived in Belgium. And so I remember just being in this cafe in Belgium and I'd got a phone call to say that they weren't going to release the single. And then I was like, I kind of knew that, you know, but I remember very clearly being in that cafe, but lots of stuff I don't remember about that time. Mm. And also something I'd forgotten, and it's funny because I found some old diaries. And the day that I wrote Nothing Good About This Goodbye, which I'd had a car crash on the way there. And then this lyric in my head. It was so weird. And then I got to Brian, and I was like, oh my God, we've got to write this song. This is the chorus. This is the lyric. And we wrote it there and then. And then on the way home from that trip, and I had forgotten about this, my mum rang me and told me she had cancer. Oh, so like literally, and I remember sitting in the car and just, so I've only got little bits of memories. Some of that time was personally so upsetting. I don't remember letting go of my managers. I don't remember signing off the letter that you have to sign off to say I'm walking away from this deal. So a lot of it, yeah. You know, I think we do that, don't we, as humans?
Yeah,
for sure.
But let's talk about Nothing Good About This Goodbye. I mean, you know, everyone's experiencing Xenomania HQ in Kent or wherever it was. Yeah. Sorry, maybe, I can't remember.
I think it was Kent. I think so.
I think everyone's got their own experience there, but I think with the song that you've created, it seems very well presented, you know, from start to finish. It doesn't feel like something that's a mishmash of different sessions and different lines and things like that. So how did that day, as far as you can remember, roll out?
Oh, well, you're absolutely right. And I had this conversation with a songwriter actually last week I was working with, called Barry Stone. I think it's Barry Stone, isn't it?
Yeah. Legend.
Jules and Stone.
Legend.
Yes.
So we were talking about Xenomania because it was such a fascinating way of working where one team would be writing a chorus in one room, one team would be writing a verse. But I turn up and I was very much like, I didn't know about that. So I just went in with Brian. I went, Brian, hi, nice to meet you. Look, I've got this idea. Can we just get started? Because I'd had this car crash. I wasn't in the mood. So I didn't get to write with all these other people. And there wasn't a mishmash writing approach because we just sat in his office, actually, I think it was. And I went, oh, can you just get a keyboard? And he was like, oh, I suppose I'll go and get a keyboard. Brought in a keyboard and then sort of plonk it, working it all out from there. And then I think I went away maybe a couple of weeks later. I'd sung a rough version of what I thought the vocal would go like. And then I came back and the song sounded completely different. You know, I was just like, wow, this is insane. With the, you know, like, because it changes sort of tempo or key or something, and it Verse two, and it was never written that way. That was production. So I was really like, oh, I love this. This is fantastic. But I didn't see all the machinations of how it worked at Xenomania. But I did go back and write another song or another couple of songs, but they never really kind of came together. Nothing good. Nothing worked as well as that did. And I think it was just because that was just like a gift from wherever. And sometimes you get a lyric and it just comes to you and you just go with the flow.
Yeah. I mean, Light Song is literally like gold dust. It is. I'm like not even joking when to me that is one of the best songs of all time.
Oh, thank you.
I do love it. I've had lots of very wistful moments with that song after my breakup, actually. Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. And do you know what? I hear this a lot. So when people write to me and slide in my DMs, my DMs are open. So, you know, I encourage this. A lot of the time, and I don't mean to minimize your experience, but people say that my music has helped them through a breakup. And I think it's because I've always written from that place. I've always written from like a relationship, emotional place. But to be able to write songs that actually make you feel better or that get you through, that's the dream. And that's the kind of songs that I want to keep on writing, very much so.
So how did you hear that Rachel Stevens was doing it?
When I stopped doing the Warner deal, I don't know how you say that, when I left or I was dropped, whatever, I wanted to get those songs covered because it felt like an enormous amount of work had gone into them. They were ready to go. And I was just, it felt like a waste. You know, because I knew there were good songs and I knew enough. I mean, obviously, I thought I'm not good enough and I hate myself, but I knew enough to know that the songs were good and they deserve to have a second life. So I don't even know how it got to Rachel, if I'm truly honest with you. I would imagine it probably was via Warner or via Warner Chappell, but I was delighted. And I know at the time there were a few artists that were sort of swarming around it, and I can't tell you who that was because I honestly can't quite remember, but it was people.
It was
like,
me, it was David,
it
was Rachel.
There was a few Chuckle Brothers. There was a few because it was, and you've got to remember that these songs were produced by or written with some of the best writers at that time.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just it's an Alexis Drum song, it's Warner's like this enough to put it on an album, so it must be good. And it was written with this guy and this guy produced it. So there was a credibility there. And then with Kylie, I just went back to Jamie Nelson, her A&R. I've always had a really good relationship with. He's fantastic. Mm. And I said, Jamie, I wrote this for Kylie. I did a version. Okay, it didn't go anywhere, but it is perfect for Kylie. You've got to listen to it again. Please consider it. And I think he appreciated that and however it got to her, I don't know. That would have been through him again. And I was just delighted. I'm still standing, keeping you dancing, yeah. You know you want it. I'm still going, making the party blow the way you like it. Wanna hear me scream? That one in particular, I wrote that with such a love of Kylie. I am so obsessed with Kylie. And to have...
We've seen the Padam Padam cover.
Yeah, I mean, that's just because, once again, I'm just obsessed with her. And so, you know, having your idol sing one of your songs, there's really nothing career-wise that can top that. And I know it wasn't a single, and I'd love for it to have been a single, because then I would have really showed off.
I didn't realise that your main mission was to write that for Kylie.
Yeah.
I was wondering whether, as part of this Addicted era, it was actually meant to be your song. I read something completely different into it, you know, when it goes, do you want to hear me sing pop? I was like, oh, is she like an artist that's coming up that's maybe going, okay, do you want me to try a different persona?
Oh, how interesting. So the Still Standing was very much, we wrote it through Kylie's perspective. I'm still standing. I'm still keeping you dancing. And that was, it felt weird for me to record it, if I'm truly honest with you, but no one noticed because they didn't know the context. But it felt weird for me to be singing that song because I haven't really had a comeback. Although now it makes sense for me to sing it.
Now you can say, I'm still standing.
But it was very much, I wanted to write it from Kylie's perspective.
Are there any other favourites from the Addicted album and era for you? Any other standouts for you?
I liked Rodeo a lot as well. I mean,
oh yes,
Coming On Strong and Rodeo were really like the two. They felt like twins. They felt like they went really well together.
After parting ways with Warner, how long was it until you got signed with Universal? And do you feel like you were hesitant to jump back into a major label situation?
Yeah, 100% I was. I think I was signed again and had the album done within 2 years, which is pretty quick if you think about it. And I was very resilient. And I think because Kylie had taken the track and Rachel had, I got that little confidence boost that, you know, I'm not as rubbish as I thought. So I continued. And then I very quickly wrote these songs that were very different and very singer-songwritery. And I just produced some majority of those songs myself at home. And I just got on with it. I don't actually know how I did it now. I look back and think, my God, how did I motivate myself to get up every day and do that? But I did, and Universal heard it, loved it, and, you know, I got offered another deal. It would have been 5 albums or whatever, had the first one done really well. So it was like a big, big thing. Want you, you're almost like a bad. I remember being really excited though when I got the deal. I was like, this is great and this is what I want, but let's just hope it works out. And you know, it's like when you go back to an ex and you're like, oh, don't do that shitty thing again. They're like, no, I won't do that shitty thing again. You're like, oh, all right then, okay. But you've always got one little foot out the door.
Yeah.
And that was sort of my approach. I was like, oh, I don't know, please work out. So I made sure I enjoyed it more the second time, and I had my voice heard more, and I made more decisions about how I looked and how the videos were. And, you know, I had a lot more input and, you know, chose hot men to be in the videos and stuff. Those songs were where I was at romantically at the time. And I was like in this really long-term relationship with someone who had a gambling addiction. And so a lot of those songs have little bits about that. So like World Without Your Love, there's placing all my bets on love, da, 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 da. I felt like, how did I live my whole life without having this love that I have for you? And now I feel like that about my daughter. I was on a losing streak till the day I met you. Now I'm winning every hand. Placing all my bets on love, it's peculiar, don't work out the way I planned. So don't bring me down. How did I get this far? In a world without.
It's a really solid album, and you can tell this is an album. You know, it's a cohesive body of work. And you got to do a launch for it at Retropop.
Yes.
I mean, it's a Retropop gig, but it's also like you did a Q&A. And how was that for you doing that?
Well, that was great because, and you know, props to Connor at Retropop because he interviewed me for the magazine quite early on in the process. And he was like, are you going to do any live gigs? And I went, oh God, no, why would I do that? No, I'm just getting it out. And then he was like, well, why don't you? And I went, oh, why don't I? And he encouraged me to do that. I would never have, I can't believe I'm back singing and performing and picking up a guitar and just walking on a stage. That's not something that I do in my daily life anymore. I've been working in IT and having a child. So, you know, I couldn't have been further from being a pop star. Literally could not be further from it. So to be doing that again, it's because of people like him, because of pop music activism on Twitter and people wanting to hear those songs properly. And so many people came forward, and they all, every single person that came forward and said, oh, that meant something to me, or I bought the sample off of eBay or whatever, made me feel like, yeah, I should do some gigs. Like, people want to hear it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's like, the thing is, pop fans find the music. We will go into the depths of, yes, eBay, YouTube, other sources. It should also all be coming back to you, you know.
And there is that whole part of me that does feel like, you know, there needs to be some justice, if you like, some pop justice, as you said, David, at the start, because it did feel unfair and wasteful. It felt like my carbon imprint for Cocoon was pretty massive. Do you know what I mean? Like, what a waste of money. So I'm pleased that, and it does feel nice to go, do you know what, 250,000 streams on Spotify within 3 months, you know, hey, Universal, you were wrong. And that feels really nice, because even if they'd have just released it, you know, they just put it out there at the time, it would have had an audience. Not maybe a huge audience, not earth-shattering numbers. But then imagine if 20 years ago, well, no, they didn't have Spotify then, but, you know, if my album had been up online for years and years and years, it would now have a following. So I'm kind of sad that, in a way, that it's taken till 2023 to actually get all those tracks uploaded. And there's still more. I still have other tracks that we didn't release that I'd like to do something with. So I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do that. What form? Am I going to write new songs and put those with it? I'm not sure at the moment, but everything deserves to be heard.
We were going to ask. Yeah, I'm sure the vaults are plenty.
The vaults are crazy.
You pulled out your Richard X CD, you know, back when people used to burn their demos onto CDs. I saw you do that.
Yeah.
I mean, and you've been in the studio with Jules and Stone. I think they're called The Alias now.
But, yes, that's
you
know, right.
Are you working on new music? Is there going to be new Alexis Strum?
I mean, that's absolutely the dream, and that's what I would like to happen. Obviously, you have to have a mechanism to do that, whether it's a label or I do it myself, but I will be doing it, because I'm back in that mode of, like, I can't do anything else. And I'm really creative at the moment. There's a lot. I mean, I was writing today with someone. I don't want to say who, but he's a 90s pop star, actually. And we've been writing together, and he's amazing. So that was really fun. And we sharing our stories and comparing our stories and everything's been fantastic. But I've been writing with lots of other songwriters. I'm tending to write the stuff for myself on my own, if I'm truly honest, because I know what I want to say, and I've got the stories that I want to tell.
Yeah, so that, you know, in the time between these two amazing albums that we've spoken about and now, you have moves into acting, into comedy, into writing for other people. Do you feel like those experiences give you a different approach to songwriting now and storytelling now as they did then 20 years ago?
Yeah, I think I've got way more confidence. I mean, I've written plays that have performed. I had one at Stratford Theatre Royal, Stratford East. I had one on at the Arcola. I've written scripts. I've written comedy stuff for Hat Trick that I've had commissioned. So I'm now going into this with a position of, like, oh, I can spin a yarn. You know, it's just storytelling. That's all it is. It's just doing it in a different format. So I've got so much more confidence, and it's lovely to sit and come up with ideas for songs again.
Listen, we are so happy for you, because honestly, this is really, I mean, apart from the fans being so persistent on social media, you've kickstarted this yourself. You know, you posted on social media, you were so open about your story and your experiences, and that, you know, really opened up this place where everyone can come and be part of your journey. And I'm so happy. We're both so happy that, you know, you've had these album releases, you're performing again, you're in sessions again. And, you know, this feels like chapter two.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope it is the next chapter.
We can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think it's really important, like, the honesty thing on social media, as much as it makes you feel icky. And afterwards, sometimes I post stuff and I'm like, oh my God, why? I feel so vulnerable now. But it's been really good. It's been really good for me, and people have really responded well to it. And I think it's good to be honest about your failures and your shortcomings. And I will continue to do that. Whatever happens, I'll still be doing TikTok and sharing those kind of honest chats about the industry and you know, trying to make it, because I think it's really important. And I want to, I'm interested in the new people that are coming up into this business as well. And, you know, and having that dialogue and seeing what their experience is.
Our audience, they know Alexis Strum, but if anyone's listening and they're new, what songs do you want them to rush and listen to first of yours?
Okay, go and listen to first album. So Addicted, go and listen to Still Standing and Nothing Good About This Goodbye and Coming On Strong and then Cocoon. Listen to the whole album, but note that there are some really good little B-sides as well that we did. I'll go my own. You know, nothing was just thrown in there, but probably World Without Your Love, because it is such a beautiful song. It's such a lovely, emotion and concept. And you know, it's like a really positive experience of love, I think. So, yeah, go and listen to that.
Yes, stream it and buy it digitally. Do get the vinyl as well, because then you can listen to it in that experience. And then go on YouTube, because you can watch the dead gorgeous Tom Ellis in the music video, along with our Alexis looking absolutely stunning. Alexis, is there anything else you want to let our listeners know or tell them about?
Just to check out my TikTok at Alexis Strum Official, I think it's called. And I only called it that because I wanted it to look fancy. it's not like there were other people trying to be me. I just thought, how do I make it sound like I'm really doing well?
Look, we've all been there. I joke on this podcast, MySpace era, I was / Joel Official, just because.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. That's cool. That's cool. We were onto something.
Amazing. And Alexis, so yeah, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, keep your eyes peeled LinkedIn. On Alexis Strum. LinkedIn. Go and buy the Cocoon vinyl and keep your eyes peeled. Look, we're desperate to hear this, whatever they're going by now, Jewels and Stone, The Alias, whatever you've just been working on with these guys. And yes, we are your next walk and catch up with Hannah Robinson. We hope you're collabing with her.
Yeah, I'll let you know more.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Alexis.
Have a lovely evening. Thank you. It's
you
been a
too.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Alexis.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. I'm really happy for her. And I hope that, you know, she continues to follow her bliss. Shout out, Alexis. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Make sure you go and follow her on all social platforms. You can follow us at Right Back Pod on all social platforms. Email our hearts at rightbackpod@gmail.com. You can follow me at Dr_JoelB, and you can follow him at
Love Limmy.
Until next time, bye.
Bye. Only now I let go, honey, I just don't know. Sit right here and watch the sky above for a sign. I'm in the wrong key.
Tell me, will you miss me when I'm in your history? Pop listeners, there is nothing good about this goodbye. Tempo change.